This is an interview with Mari Osharoff for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. I'm William Thomas. The date is June 8th, 2015, and we're in Rockville, Maryland. So thank you very much for agreeing to speak with us about your 40 years at the SEC. But why don't we begin with a little bit of your biographical background, where you came from, how you became interested in law, and ultimately how you ended up at the SEC.
Well, I was born in Washington, D.C., and grew up in the Maryland suburbs. I went to college at Radcliffe, which is now part of Harvard. Sadly, they lost their name. And then I went to Yale Law School. When I was at Radcliffe, I majored in the history and literature of England, which I enjoyed very much. And, of course, my mother said, "What will you do with English?" And I said, "I'll speak it." But I did know I had to make a living. And so what do English majors do? They go to law school. And back then, I think it was also, I don't think women were necessarily as imaginative about careers as they were now. My father was a lawyer, and although I didn't necessarily have a conscious decision to be just like him, especially since he was a patent lawyer, which involves a large scientific background, that was probably in my mind. So I went to law school, and I have to tell you, I never had any interest in economics or any issue that you might think would be related to the SEC. I did not necessarily want to go into that field at all. I'm not sure what field of law I wanted to go into exactly, but I took a corporate law course, not because I expected it to be interesting, but I thought it was probably a good basic thing to have, and I in fact did find it very interesting. Then, when it came time to apply for summer jobs, I ought to go back and say that when you work in Washington, when you live in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. you generally think of the government as an employer. And I did have summer jobs with the government all the way through college, starting in high school as a grade 2 clerk typist. I would have been able to get a grade 3, except that I failed the typing test. I not only failed the typing test, I dropped my typewriter and broke it. So this was not a good day. But I did work for a number of government agencies. And in my first year of law school, I worked for the Department of Transportation. Between my second and third year, I did interview with law firms as well. But the best job offer I got actually was with the SEC. Stan Sporkin and Alan Levinson came to the law school and interviewed, and so it seemed like an attractive offer. These were not unpaid internships the way they do now. Mm-hmm. This was a grade 9, and that was a pretty good salary to me. It was actually not that far off what I might have made with a law firm. So I did come to the SEC, and I really enjoyed it. They treated me like a new attorney, which is nice when you consider that they didn't know that they were going to get any more out of me but 2 or 3 months, although it turned out they got a lot more. They showed me how to review a proxy statement, how to review a filing. The filings were likely to be a post-effective amendment to an S-8. Form S-8, which is for employee benefit plan now, is automatically effective, and nobody looks at them at all. But in those days, we looked at them. Post-effective amendments we looked at. So they weren't necessarily the most important filings, but it was a little bit of a thrill to me. I would write up my comments. My grand chief, Phil Farnsworth, would review them, or maybe somebody, one of the more senior people in the branch. Then he said, "Okay, go ahead and call and give comments to the attorney who listed as the contact person." And of course, here I was a summer employee giving comments, and they didn't let their people talk to the SEC until they had more experience. The first time I gave comments on a registration statement, the attorney said, "Well, these comments are very easy for us to take care of. I assume you'll let us do that in the 424. which to anybody who's been at the SEC longer than a month or so, any attorney, you would know that means we don't have to file a formal amendment, do we? We can do it in the final prospectus filed under Rule 424. However, I was didn't know what he was talking about, so I had to say, well, I'm not familiar with that. Let me talk to my branch chief, and I'll get back to you. So this was pretty funny, but in subsequent years, when I trained people myself, I always explained this to them. I had a colleague who said he made the mistake of asking, when he was a new attorney, asking a company for their fourth quarter 10-Q and saying, well, I see the first three quarters, I don't see the fourth quarter. Of course, there is no fourth quarter 10-Q. It's a 10-K for the whole year. So we all, I guess, go through those things, but I did feel very pleased that I was allowed to actually work on filings and talk to people on the outside. One interesting thing that showed you how our ethics rules have changed is when I first arrived as a summer employee, I was told, oh, call up these financial printers and they'll send you, they're Baum, they're Tycor, they're Charles B. Young. Call them up, tell them you work for the SEC and ask them to send you sets of the rules. They all had different services with SEC rules and forms. The SEC did not have its own. Now, of course, in addition to the fact that everything is available online, there's also a special CCH set that SEC professionals have access to. But back then, we didn't have our own, and so you called the financial printer, then you got their set, which would certainly not be allowed today. However, I ended up enjoying the job very much, and then I decided, well, I should take a security law course at Yale. And so the fall semester of my third year, I took a security law course, and I actually did not like it at all. Mm-hmm. It was the professor focus on the national market system and not on quick fin type issues. So if I had just taken that course and never come to work to the SEC, I would probably not have done so, but I remember that I had enjoyed the disclosure work for the SEC.
What is it about the corporate side versus the market side that you find particularly appealing?
It is hard to say. I like the idea of dealing directly with companies. Mm-hmm. And I also, as I said, I never did have that big an interest in economics, so the market side seemed to be more economics-driven in some respects. It turned out, I think it worked well for me because at the SEC, the Division of Market Regulation, which had gone through many names, is very specialized. There are different specialized aspects, and I just enjoyed the corp fin side. It was rare that I thought about changing divisions, and in the end, I never did change divisions. Ideally, I will say from the perspective of my career, maybe there should have been more variety, not only different divisions of the SEC, but also the ideal career would have a mix of government service and private practice. So I certainly respected the people I worked with who did have private practice experience, and I made a point of trying to learn from them, but I didn't have that variety myself.
Okay.
So, at any rate, was applying for jobs, permanent jobs as opposed to summer jobs, getting ready to graduate, I was happy to get an offer from the SEC, and I was very pleased with my salary of over $14,000 a year. It was not that much less than what law firms were paying at the time. Had I known the difference, maybe I would have been more inclined at some point to seek out private practice, although whether I would have ended up, in fact, making some of those spectacular amounts, who knows. But I really liked the idea of the public service, and the salary was fine for me. And I got started then in what they call a branch. I guess they don't call them branches, but now they call that part of the division operations.
Okay.
Which is not a term that was used when I was when I was first there. But I was in Ox. I was in a branch, and my first branch chief was Charlie Leber.
And how do you spell the last name?
L-E-B-E-R.
Okay.
And people thought it was very funny because in addition to a secretary who was a woman, I became the, I think, third professional woman in his branch, and this was really quite startling. There was a woman accountant who may have been the only woman accountant in Corp Fin at the time, and there was a woman financial analyst, and then there was a lawyer, and people would make jokes about Charlie's harem because he had the three professional women in his branch, but that was a long time ago. And I...
Just put some signposts on this. What year did you join?
I was a summer employee in 73, and I joined in 74.
Okay.
And we'll come back to the position of women, but this might be a good time for me to mention my first SEC Speaks conference that I attended, which was, I guess, in 1975. A few months after I joined, was a little bit of a revelation. I walked in and I signed up as a staff member, and they handed me a card with my name on it across the top, and I said, what am I supposed to do with that? And they said, put it in your breast pocket. Well, if you were wearing a suit that didn't have a breast pocket, or maybe not even wearing a suit at all, this was not convenient, and they certainly didn't have pins or other things that women could use. Then I looked around, having been sensitized to this issue, I looked around the room. There were hundreds of people. And I began counting the women. And there were fewer than 10. It was very odd. There were a few women I knew who were at the SEC. Then I would say to myself, okay, there's the woman in the red dress over there. There's the woman in the blue suit, but there were, I think, fewer than 10. And it was a surprise to me because in my law school, women were not, there weren't as many women as there would be today, but there were a lot of women. We were not rare.
Right.
And I felt that we were rare in the SEC Speaks setting. And then I also thought to myself, gee, everybody's white, which again was very different from my law school. And I began counting the African-Americans and Asians. I think there was one Asian. Maybe there were five or six African-Americans, most of whom were also women. So it was a very different era.
Atmospherically, was it a respectful atmosphere, or was it a little bit... You know?
It was I thought it was a respectful atmosphere. Not everybody necessarily had the same experience, but... I didn't feel that my work was respected any less for being a woman.
Okay.
The work I did was kind of a nice follow-on to the work I did as a summer employee, so my training did prove valuable. I was reviewing filings, transactional filings, 10-Ks, proxy statements. I particularly learned to love proxy contests, which are very interesting because both sides are hostile to each other and the staff ends up being a little bit of a mediator. The two sides may be fighting over what color proxy card to use because we had an informal rule that they could not both use the same color. And so if one side picked the color the other side wanted, there would be some resentment. When proxy contests first came in, when you were first aware of a proxy contest, because a piece of opposition material was filed. This is before filings. Proxy material was not public, and in fact, since we didn't yet have Edgar, which I'll come to, even when filings were public, it would take a while for people to know they existed. So the staff practice, when we became aware of a proxy contest, was to send telegrams to both sides saying, we are aware there may be a contest for control, and basically saying, in nicer language, keep your mouth shut, don't make any inappropriate statements that could end up being violations of the proxy rules. So it's kind of funny to think about those telegrams. But the proxy contest were definitely among the work that I enjoyed the most. they were maybe because they were hostile, it was fun. Mm-hmm. They're very fast moving. Two developments that occurred in operations while I was still in operations were industry centralization and selective review. Industry centralization meant that instead of the industry being scattered randomly among the branches, which had been true with a few exceptions, real estate and mining, I think, were treated separately when I was there, but other industries were random. But instead, they decided that putting a select number of industries in each branch would work better because the staff members could get familiar with the industries and know the disclosure issue, but at the same time they wouldn't be so specialized they only worked on one industry. They would have enough of a variety to keep things interesting. That strikes me as almost a no-brainer, but it was very different with selective review. I was not at a policy-making level at the time. Mm-hmm. This would have been the late 70s, I think, possibly early 80s, but I'm not sure. But obviously there were lots of high-level discussions on selective review because every single piece of paper that came in the door had been reviewed, even a plain election of directors proxy that didn't involve a contest or any big legal issue. The employee benefit plans on Form SA, very routine post-effective amendments, they were all reviewed, and we didn't really have the staff for it. So they decided to go to a selective review system where only the higher priority things would be reviewed. And now it certainly makes a lot of sense, not to mention that Corp Fin, instead of having about 400 people, which I think is what they have now, mm-hmm. would probably have to have 4,000. But at the time, I was appalled. They called us into a big division meeting and told us about selective review. And I was appalled. And I remember talking to one of my other coworkers, and I said, I guess it's not the end of the world. And he said, well, it's the end of Corp Fin.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very funny how we took the news. When I was in operations, at a certain point, I became an assistant director's special counsel.
Can I ask you before we proceed?
Okay, sure.
So the function of operations in general, is that just to kind of determine how things like reviews are done or how they're conducted in the rest of the division? Or what, maybe I should just let you explain.
Okay, well, operation mm-hmm. is really the core of the division. I say that as someone who spent most of my time in support. Mm-hmm. You have operations, then you have support and the support offices. Operations does really what it... They perform what is the core mission of the division, which is to review the filings that come in, as well as to... obviously, they get into the policies of what the disclosure should be, but the disclosure is really what it's all about. The whole premise, I guess I should say this for people listening to this who are not otherwise as familiar with Corp Fin, the whole premise of the disclosure system is that it is disclosure, it's sunshine, it's not a merit regulation system. We don't tell investors, you cannot invest in this because you're not sophisticated enough or because this is not a good deal for you. We tell investors, here are all the facts about the company, and if you want to invest, go ahead. It may be a terrible deal, and you'll see risk factors, and you'll see other disclosures saying it's a terrible deal. Now, I'm aware this doesn't always work because sometimes brokers will tell their clients, oh, ignore that, all that stuff. The SEC makes them say that it's really a wonderful deal, and some people don't bother to read it, so it's not the ultimate protection, but if the attempt did not to be overly paternalistic. This is especially for registered offerings. There are certain exceptions in our rule permitting offerings of security to investors that are not on a registered basis, and that gets a little more complicated because it's not merit regulation exactly. Some of the states have that. We don't, but there is a more highly regulated system of who's allowed to buy those offerings. With respect to registered offerings, disclosure is the key, and therefore the staff reviewing the disclosure, commenting on it, and having companies respond to those comments is very important. We always thought of ourselves, too, as being very accessible. It wasn't just like a faceless bureaucracy, and it still isn't. Letters of comment have the names of contact people. People are encouraged to call them. And usually a lawyer in my case now, of course the accountants would talk to accountants, but lawyers on the outside would be talking to lawyers or sometimes financial analysts on the staff about the response to comments. We encourage people to call with questions and not just send an answer without knowing what we were getting at if the letter of comment didn't make it clear. So we had a lot of interaction by phone, and the staff still does. Even in these email days, it was a long time before comment letter could go out by email, but the staff is not necessarily encouraged to communicate a lot with the outside by email because you don't want something in writing that says this is an explanation of our comment unless it's really been vetted by the right people. Mm-hmm. So it's actually better to have informal conversations. And we did that. One amusing sideline.
A little bit ahead of ourselves maybe, but that's an interesting point. I mean, was there encouragement to continue using telephone conversations then and that sort of thing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. It's definitely not an all-email kind of thing. If someone wants to know, well, what did you mean by the comment asking for more disclosure by about such and such, we think we've done an adequate job. The easiest way is to have a conversation. And people are encouraged to go up to the chain if they want to appeal something. It's not my way or the highway kind of thing. Having said that, it's not a good idea if people want to start out by calling the division director because he was their buddy in private practice. It is better to go through the chain, but I think we always prided ourselves on being very accessible, and I believe that's still true on the staff today.
Okay. Can I ask you also, in clarification, so back to the point about the function of operations, does that then encompass the branches, or does it stand separate?
It encompasses the branches.
I see. Okay.
Okay. And now we generally call them the AD group, the assistant director group.
Okay.
Each assistant director has branches under him or her. And now they are divided into legal branches and accounting branches. That wasn't the case when I was there. There would be each assistant director would have maybe three branches. Mm-hmm. The numbers varied, headed up by a branch chief who was usually a lawyer or a financial analyst, although sometimes could be an accountant, and then there would be attorneys and accountants and financial analysts in the branches to work on filing, and every filing that contained financial statements would be assigned to an accountant as well as to an attorney or a financial analyst. There's a lot less hiring of financial analysts these days. In fact, I don't know if they've done it for a long time. It's generally professional or generally attorneys or accountants, with some exceptions for very specialized things. For example, mining or oil and gas companies might also have an engineer assigned.
Okay. And so your initial title was attorney advisor. Is that just kind of the standard?
That's the standard title.
Okay. Okay. As far as the people who review
the
forms that come in and that sort of
thing. Yes.
Okay.
I think now they allow some people to be called senior counsel, who've been there for a while but have not gotten a more formal title, but that wasn't the case when I was in operation. One thing I should mention, when we sent out letters of comment, the secretary did the typing. There were no computers. The professional didn't do the typing. Of course, that meant that there would be a backlog, and the poor secretaries had to use carbon paper and make a number of copies. I think the blue was for the mailroom and the yellow was for the branch files. And if when the secretary typed it, the professional would make, would proofread it, and the secretary would get highly annoyed if there were mistakes to be corrected, because with all those carbon papers, it would not be an easy thing. Over time, the transition was made to computers and professionals doing their own typing, which is something we may come back to, but at the time it was a very labor-intensive process, and sometimes, well, in the case of proxy contest, we would read the comments over the phone because they were very time-sensitive, and we wanted to get the comments out as fast as possible, and then we would follow them up in a letter. And it was very annoying reading the comments over the phone if you were reading them to a lawyer who would stop and interrupt and say, what do you mean by this? What do you mean by that? So I would always encourage them to have a secretary on the other end take dictation or else do a tape recorder to avoid that, although it wasn't always possible to avoid that.
Okay, so before we kind of, to loop back around, you had then moved on to a different position you were about to talk about?
Yeah, there was still an operations. Each assistant director had a special counsel who got to be a grade 14. Now the career ladder for attorneys goes up to grade 14, but back then the career ladder only went up to 13. So if you wanted to get a 14, you had to get a promotion, which usually meant you had to be competing with people. And I applied for my share of jobs that I didn't get at the grade 14 level. Back in those days, the way they told you if you didn't get a job, they would give you a blue special attention envelope which said, thank you for applying for such and such job, but we decided to select such and such other person. So if you saw one of the administrative people in the division coming toward you with a blue envelope, you knew you were in trouble. Now they do it in a more civilized way, which is they have a face-to-face conversation. But in any event, this was a job that I got. I should say, however, one of the jobs I didn't get was an assistant director's special counsel job, which I really wanted, and it was on my 30th birthday that I found out I didn't get the job. So at the time, that seemed like a terrible day. Not only did I not get the job, but I was 30, and that is, thought of 30 being so awful is pretty amusing now. However, the next special counsel job that came along I did get, I was special counsel to Irving Borokoff. And I may have been the first woman to actually be an assistant director's special counsel. I didn't know Irv that well. He was a branch chief that I knew before he got promoted to being an assistant director. I found out he was very smart, and he was also, I feel like I got my start at learning how to think like a manager, because he would bounce ideas off me, not only substantive ideas, but also ideas about people and his concerns about people, that there was somebody who was very good in his group, but he felt that person wasn't necessarily recognized as being that good by other people. What could we do about it? And things like that. So I learned to, I was not formally a supervisor, but in a certain sense I was, because part of my job was to supervise proxy contests in the division, in that group, and part of the job was to help train other people in the group. So I was maybe a de facto supervisor in some of my responsibilities, and that was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that very much.
Were there kind of informal mentorship roles going on at that time? Like, did you experience them, or did you mentor anyone later on?
I don't think I experienced them. The word mentor wasn't really in vogue, I don't think. I felt like there were senior people I got to know who were always very good at answering questions. There was were a couple of people in the chief counsel's office in the division, which I should say, and the chief counsel's office, not to be confused with the general counsel's office, which is a separate office unto itself, but the chief counsel's office
within
is an office
division,
within Corp Fin. And there were people there that were very good at answering questions. And so that's how I learned, in addition to my direct supervisors on a matter. I always tried to be available and accessible. And when I got my next position, which was deputy chief counsel, I really particularly enjoyed training people. Mm-hmm. I became deputy chief counsel in 1985. This was a very exciting promotion, not only to a grade 15, which was really rare in the division, but more important, it was really my first division-wide position. And it was unusual that I had not been in the chief counsel's office first. I got promoted that job directly from being an assistant director of special counsel. Mm-hmm. And there was although there were certainly some good people in the chief counsel's office at the time, none of them were viewed as having the right amount of, I guess, seniority and seasoning for that position. Bill Morley was the chief counsel, and Bill was just a wonderful and delightful person, very smart, very down to earth, very interested in sports. And I joked with him that at least they couldn't say his selection of me was the old boys network, mm-hmm. because I had a complete lack of interest in sports and cars. But Bill thought it worked out well, because that way if he wanted to take off time to go watch a University of Maryland game, he didn't have to worry about my wanting the same thing. Mm-hmm. One reason I got the job, I believe, is David Martin, who subsequently became the director of the division of Corp Fin. At the time, he had been in the chief counsel's office, but he had very recently gone up to the chairman's office to work with Linda Quinn, who was the executive assistant. She brought a couple of attorneys from Corp Fin with her to work for the chairman, and David Martin was one of them. So he was no longer in the chief counsel's office. I said to Bill Morley at one point, I bet if, this was after I worked for him a couple of years, I said, I bet if David had still been in the chief counsel's office, he would have got the deputy chief counsel job. And Bill laughed and said, yeah, you're right. So I was very, especially when many years later David became my division director, I expressed to him my great appreciation of the fact that he went up to the chairman's office when he did and cleared the way for me. That job was actually the best job I ever had, and I enjoyed it so much. It was very intellectually challenging, because we did a lot. We did interpretive work. We answered questions about the rules and the form. There was a lot of telephone duty. Some of us got a little tired of that, because we could answer dozens of phone calls a day, and the call could vary from someone who was planning a very sophisticated new securities product and wanted to know some of the ramifications for how to comply with the rule, to someone who didn't bother to look up the rule himself and just wanted to know, wanted to be spoon-fed. Mm-hmm. And there were times when I would say, you need to look at release numbers such and such, and after you've read the release, please call me if you have more questions. We would sometimes get associates who were afraid to consult with other people in their law firm, so they would call the SEC to ask the question, which is a practice that probably would not have been encouraged by the law firm. So we got all kinds of questions. It drove the secretary crazy. This is before they had an answering machine. And the phone was constantly ringing. And we all took turns, including Bill Morley, who was the chief counsel.
In those days, before everything was available via the Internet, would companies generally have files of not only the rules, but all the releases and that sort of thing that the SEC would put out?
Well, we would put out releases from time to time. We had a couple of releases on the process of filing a request for a no-action or interpretive letter. And of course, when rules were proposed and then adopted, there would be public releases. The releases weren't as long as the ones today, but they would still have some helpful guidance. Not like back in the 30s and 40s, the SEC would issue a release saying, "We have decided to adopt the following rule," and then there would be the text of the rule. But over the decade, the releases got longer and there was more explanatory material, and those were very helpful to the public.
And those would just go out to a subscriber list or something like that? I'm just curious how the physical documents...
They would be in law libraries, okay, as well as the SEC library, and they would be available in a more general way. Oh, financial printers would issue compilations of them and send them to their clients. In fact, this may be a good time to just talk about the evolution of technology
in that regard.
Mm-hmm. When I came, I told you not only did we not... The SEC didn't have its own sets of rules for its own employees, but it was hard to do research if someone presented you with a question on the staff. And, of course, on the outside, you would also have difficulties. On the staff, you would have index files. Some people would maintain card files. They were very informal. Some people, the chief counsel's office had card files, but sometimes they were better maintained than others. And you could find them. Then they had microfiche. And the microfiche was a real pain to use. It was not well indexed, and you would have to get a microfiche for a particular month, and it was pretty dreadful. Then they started with Lexis, and that was very exciting. When I was in law school, I remember grumbling about the fact that they told us how to shepherdize cases and saying that this all ought to be on a computer. Unbeknownst to me, people were developing computerized systems of legal research, and Lexis and Westlaw were being developed. And so at a certain point, it wasn't available right after I came to the SEC, but within a few years, Lexis was available, and I think subsequently Westlaw, and the SEC releases, as well as the interpretive and no action letters were available. But at first, we were not encouraged to spend a lot of time on Lexis because the division had a budget. And I remember one of the best attorneys in Corp Fin got into a little trouble with the division director, Linda Quinn, who sent her a note saying, you've used Lexis too much, using too much of our budget. And the attorney was not very happy because she had been putting in all kinds of extra hours, and this would not be... she was not using the system frivolously. Of course, now there is, the SEC pays for subscriptions, and I don't know how it works, but it's certainly not on an hourly basis. But at the time, Lexis was a precious, rare commodity. And so when I first joined the chief counsel's office, I think we still had some of those index cards and microfiche, and maybe Lexis was just starting to be used. As a side note, Post-its were also just starting to be used. So that may not really come under the heading of technology, but it seemed like a significant change. I'll come back, I think, to Edgar and electronic filing, but just talking about my time at Deputy Chief Counsel, it was a lot of fun because I got to write memos to the division attorneys addressing different disclosure issues. Form S-4, which was a registration form for mergers and acquisitions, was brand new. I had not been involved in the rulemaking, but I was involved in the interpretation, and I put together a long memo that listed all of the interpretations, and I just enjoyed telling people things, I guess. At the time I was promoted, the division director was John Huber, and the associate director legal was Kathy McCoy. So I worked for John and Kathy and then Bill Morley, that was my chain of command. Kathy was lovely and very nice to work for. John was very smart, and I was a little intimidated by him, although I subsequently learned he was he had a sense of humor, and I respected him very highly. I was a little nervous when he first became division director because at the time, the going private rules were new, Rule 13(e)(3), that was a very new, exciting development, And John had worked on the rulemaking, and I was answering some shareholder, some chairman's correspondence. This is when I was a branch attorney, and it involved going private rules. And so I would ask to consult with John, who would then involved with the rulemaking on how to answer it, and he suggested I say something, and I said, and I argued with him a bit, and I said, well, if I say this, shouldn't I say this instead? And he said, well, why did you consult me then? And I said, well, I would have to consult with you to see what you said. I didn't think I had to take your word that's fiat from the Pope. It's actually very funny. A, I'm not Catholic. B, he then became my division director, and I told my mother, well, the guy that I told I didn't regard his word as fiat from the Pope had just become the head of the division, and she said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'll kiss his ring. So Rule 13E3 was something significant for us all to deal with, and similarly there were new tender offer rules. Mm-hmm. Now I want to back up a little bit and say, when I was an AD special counsel, the division decided that one of the jobs of the AD's special counsel would be to review tender offers.
Were the issues that you were dealing with under, did different ADs have different jurisdictions?
No, because the tender offers were assigned by whether the target company was in your branch or not. Mm-hmm. So there were, I don't know how many assistant directors at the time, say eight. Okay. And so maybe there were eight special counsel. And the Office of Tender Offers at that point, which had subsequently was renamed the Office of Mergers and Acquisition, at the time it was the Office of Tender Offers. It was very small. It was headed by a woman named Ruth Appleton, who was one of the few women in high positions at that time. And there was a set of new tender, and she had a couple of attorneys working for her, but it was a small office. So the division made the decision that the assistant director's special counsel would have as one of their duties reviewing the tender offers and giving the comment. So Ruth trained the special counsel. I missed out on that training because I was not yet a special counsel. And she retired just around the time I became a special counsel. So I got my training in other ways, but I really loved the tender offers. Along with proxy contests, they were some of the most interesting filings, especially some tender offers were hostile takeovers.
Yeah.
No, not all of them, but a lot of them were.
Sorry, so, we're circa 1980 right now.
Yes, yeah. Right. We're in the early 80s.
Right.
And
so it's really becoming a prominent issue even in the press. Right.
Right. And when I became deputy chief counsel, I did miss the proxy contests and tender offers, although they came back to me, and you will see. But at the time, it seemed too bad having to give up that responsibility. But, you know, aside from that, as I said, it was really the best job I ever had. A bunch of us would stand around late talking, just not because we were under a severe deadline necessarily, but just because issues were so exciting and challenging. Well, that era came to an end when I moved on. Although I should say, my rulemaking career really began while I was deputy chief counsel. Rulemaking was generally the province of an office which at that time was called the Office of Disclosure Policy. Subsequently, now it's called the Office of Rulemaking, but the Disclosure Policy Office handled the rulemaking, but at one point they didn't have the staff to handle a project. It involved changing the rule relating to filing fees, and it had been proposed, but there was a push to get the rule adopted, and there was a staff shortage in that rule. So the associate director, Kathy McCoy, came to the chief counsel, Bill Morley, and said, could you lend me one of your attorneys to help out with the rulemaking? Well, around that time I had a cold, and every time I had a cold it changed to laryngitis because of all the telephone calls in that office. So as I reconstruct things later, Bill probably thought to himself, who is the most useless person in my office that I can offer up to Kathy for this rulemaking project? And he offered me up, since I couldn't talk on the phone for a few days. So I got involved in the rulemaking project. So evidently I did a good job on that, because I was spotted by Kathy as someone who could do that. In the meantime, Linda Quinn became division director. I had known her when she first joined Corp Fin as an attorney fellow. Then she went up the chair's office to be the chair's executive assistant, which is a position that is now called chief of staff. Then she came down to Corp Fin when John Huber left to be the division director. And shortly after she became division director, she said, I want to take you out to lunch. And I was a little bit alarmed. And she said, it's nothing bad. I had worked with Linda when she was up in the chairman's office. I had done a report on tender offers for tender offer regulation in different countries for the advisory committee on tender offers that was ongoing at that time. That was when I was still an AD special counsel. Mm-hmm. And she had complimented my work on that report. But I hadn't really worked that much with her in after that, when I was deputy chief counsel. But when she took me out to lunch, she said, I would like you to head up an Edgar rulemaking task force. Edgar was just getting started. There was a pilot program to accept filings electronically at the SEC. And there was a decision to make it mandatory for companies to file electronically with the SEC, which was at the time a very forward-looking and controversial decision. And Linda felt that the rule would have to be very significantly changed to take into account electronic filing. And she said to me, you know, don't keep your title as deputy chief counsel, but in reality, the work you do will be for this rulemaking task force. I'd like to have three or four very good attorneys working with you on this rulemaking, and you'll be in charge. I was, in a way, somewhat hesitant because I really liked my position, which is why Linda made a point of saying you will keep your title. And so I agreed to do it. And we had a task force which had many meetings. We put together a report that analyzed the different rules and the changes that would need to be made. And that ended up being a very significant strand of my career because I was involved in Edgar rulemaking and policy issues in one way or another for my whole career, even when it didn't necessarily make sense according to the organization chart. Starting in about 1984, I have the years wrong. Yes, I knew that was wrong. In the early 90s, we did a concept release, but we actually then did rulemaking to phase in companies, public companies, to have to make their filings electronically starting in 1993. And that applied only to domestic companies. Foreign private issuers didn't have to do that until 2002. So this was all ongoing all through the 90s in good rulemaking. It was very, as I said, controversial. We were the first country, so far as I know, to have an electronic system for securities filing. This is before the internet, so people who wanted the public filings could subscribe to them. They weren't disseminated as broadly and as easily as they are today, but it was still a huge improvement.
How would they be submitted onto Edgar?
Well, there was submitted on Edgar. It was there was a computer system. There still is. It's not just you send it over the internet.
Right.
There is a system in place where you would get your security codes and log on and submit it. Originally, the filings had to be an ASCII. Ultimately, we allowed HTML. At first, you couldn't have any pictures, and this got you in some interesting interpretive questions. If you wanted to have a graph in your filing, you would have to give the data points in the electronic one because you couldn't present it in electronic format. Now you can do that, but back then you couldn't. If you wanted, if it was a proxy statement, you wanted pictures of the board of directors, you would just say picture the board of directors omitted. I would joke when I was on the public speaking circuit about how you don't have to describe what they look like. And in fact, if I really had a comfortable audience, I would say you don't have to say pictures of 12 middle-aged white males omitted. But that's getting ahead of myself a little bit. But I started in my Edgar career with the being the head of an Edgar rulemaking task force. In the meantime, Kathy McCoy left, which meant there was a vacancy for the associate director legal job. And at that time, the rulemaking office and the chief counsel's office both reported to that position. Well, it was a very attractive position to me, and I wanted it. Linda Quinn wanted an outsider. She went around giving speeches, telling people she wanted an outsider for that position. And in the meantime, I Bill Morley said he was not going to apply for it because he did not like rulemaking, and he did not want rulemaking as one of his principal responsibilities. Elise Walter was the deputy director at the time, and she was one of, by the way, one of the best people I ever worked for and worked with. She was one of the smartest people, as well as a very warm person, very easy to get along with. And I did a lot of work with her and on the Edgar rulemaking and otherwise. And I did make it clear I was interested in the position. Well, apparently, the outsiders who applied for the position weren't satisfactory, and I guess Linda had second thought. And the next thing I knew, they decided to post a different position. It was called the Associate Director of Regulatory Policy. The Chief Counsel's Office was not going to report to it, but the Rulemaking Office, the Office of Disclosure Policy, was. And I did apply for that, and I got it. And I was sorry to be leaving the Chief Counsel's Office and not have that under my wing, because I love the Chief Counsel's Office. And to this day, I would say one of my career regrets that I never got to be Chief Counsel. In a sense, I was promoted from Deputy Chief Counsel to Associate Director. But subsequently, they posted another job. They called it Associate Director Legal. This had the Chief Counsel, Chief Counsel's Office, but it did not have the rulemaking because I already had rulemaking. So Bill Morley applied for that job because it didn't include rulemaking, and he was Chief Counsel anyhow, so he became the Associate Director Legal, which was combined with the Chief Counsel position. So he got a promotion too, which is good, because I have to admit, if we'd been competing, you know, most likely he would have got the job. If it didn't involve rulemaking, I'm sure he would have got the job. So it worked out well that we both had promotion. I still felt a little bit of regret that my career path took me away from the Chief Counsel's Office, but certainly I could not complain that rulemaking wasn't interesting. And for the first time, I was actually a supervisor of record. When I was Deputy Chief Counsel, I got the Supervisory Excellence Award, which I was very proud of, but I wasn't a formal supervisor. I was more of an informal supervisor and tried to be a teacher and a helper to people. When I became Associate Director, I enjoyed supervising not only the office chief, but I was a second line supervisor to the attorneys in the office, some of whom were very talented. Of course, as a supervisor, there are bad aspects as well as good aspects. You're not necessarily happy if you have to give someone negative feedback or to try to get someone to improve in a way that may not always be well taken. You, on the other hand, you're dealing with good people, you're fostering their careers. So in general, I would say I really enjoyed being a supervisor throughout my career, although I have to say it was not always an easy task.
Coming back to an earlier point, was this the first time that the associate directors were becoming more specialized in this way, with responsibilities?
The division is very different right now. There are lots of associate directors operation. There are not as many, there are fewer associate directors for the support offices, but they did give them their function. There used to, I think, be maybe one associate director of operation, one associate director legal. Mm-hmm. And so I think they did become more and more specialized at that point.
It was more of an evolutionary process, yes, though, than yes, anything else.
Yes.
Okay. So prior to your very direct involvement with rulemaking, how prominent would things like, or how big of an effect would things like the tender offer rules or shelf disclosure or something like that, that, you know, is very important from a rulemaking perspective, how would that impinge on your work before you had arrived in that position? Was it an adjustment, or was it more radical than that?
Well, are you saying the rules that were passed before I got involved with them?
Yes, exactly. I mean, you'd be involved in applying the rules, and
yes,
so I'm wondering...
So I'm wondering...
how much of an effect changes in the rules would have on, you know, how you went about your work.
They certainly did, because when there were new rules, there was always training. I think the division actually was way back, and it still is very good at training its staff. So if there are new rules put into effect, there might be division-wide meetings, there might be memos, depending, of course, on the significance of the rule. So when new tender offer rules were put into effect, the Office of Tender Offers did training for that. So it is interesting, though, when you're interpreting the rule, you kind of say to yourself, why didn't the rulemakers think of this? When you do rulemaking, you realize why the rulemakers didn't think of this. In the first place, maybe they did think of it, but it would have made the rule too long or complex. And in the second place, it is also true that there's nothing like practice to show you how a rule is working. Mm-hmm. And theoretically, if you had a perfect rule, there would be no need for interpretation. But I'm not sure that such a rule exists at that point. Can we take a break?
Certainly. Okay, so why don't we talk a little bit about some of the key rules that you are dealing with once you took up this position. We've talked a little bit about EDGAR, but now, of course, your remit is much more expansive.
Yes, and over time, there were many. We worked on changing to the beneficial ownership reporting system, Regulation 13D. We worked on... And actually, this may be my first highly significant rulemaking project, Section 16, which are rules requiring companies, requiring officers, directors, and 10% shareholders of companies to report their purchases and sales of the company's securities. And also, these rules provide for recovery of short swing profit from officers and directors and large shareholders who have purchases and sales or sales and purchases within a 6-month period. We engaged in some very controversial rulemaking to modernize that system. We had rulemaking at several proposals culminating in adoption in 1991 and a further round of rulemaking in 1996, as well as maybe miscellaneous rulemaking here and there on the Section 16 system. At the time we got started with this project, not only were some of the rules very difficult to understand and requiring a lot of interpretive work, but also they were, the reporting rules were not well followed. Companies were, or insiders, I should say, because it's the responsibility of the individual, not of the company. These insiders were not filing their required filings, and there was a large delinquency rate, which was embarrassing. And we worked with the Division of Enforcement on a coordinated approach where enforcement would bring more cases when they found that violations of the reporting requirements. But we also worked on our rules in a manner to try to encourage companies to get more involved with the rules, because the officers and directors, after all, were with the company. The 10% holders may or may not have been friendly to the company, but we felt that companies should at least report delinquencies on behalf of their officers and directors. And in various other ways, we got the rule modernized, and we encouraged reporting to take place on a more timely basis. We also provided a treatment of derivative securities that worked with the rules. I have to give credit to Brian Lane, who subsequently became a division director. At the time, he was an attorney in the rulemaking office, and he came up with suggestions for a scheme for treating securities and their derivatives as being the same for purposes of analyzing whether purchase and sales had taken place. So in other words, if you purchase an option for securities, that should be treated as the same as purchasing security directly. It's, of course, more complicated than that, but it was a very it was a scheme that required a lot of thought and analysis and a lot of persuasive work. And I have to say, Brian had to persuade his office chief, then he had to persuade me, then he had to persuade, or then we had to persuade the associate director, the deputy director and the division director. And it worked out very well. I was very proud of the regulatory scheme we came up with. So I actually want to say that was my first very highly significant project. Then I mentioned, then I mentioned the beneficial ownership reporting system, calling for reports on Schedule 13D and 13G in the tender offer area.
In that case, beneficial ownership, is that like where they have different classes of stock? Is that related to those discussions?
Well, it's beneficial ownership. It's not necessarily record ownership. You might own security is a matter of record, but not have voting power or investment power. And we do have rules providing that voting, and for purposes of this regulatory scheme, that voting and investment power are the most important. So if you hold securities, but you have other... If I hold securities, but I have signed an irrevocable power of attorney, giving voting power to someone else, I no longer have it. But and if I don't have the power to sell those securities, maybe I don't have beneficial ownership at all. It's a complex concept, and beneficial ownership is defined differently for different purposes. For purposes of the Section 16 reporting rules and short swing profit rule, beneficial ownership is defined in terms of pecuniary interest. So there are many different ways of going when you figure out who is the ultimate owner of securities for a purpose of determining who's subject to the regulations. In the case of the 13D reporting scheme, it's different from Section 16. You have 5% holders, not 10% holders, of securities who have to file certain reports with the SEC, listing their holdings, and in certain cases, the purposes of their holding and changes in their holdings. So I worked a lot with that regulatory scheme. Then we had the regulatory scheme for takeovers and security holder communication, which fondly known as Regulation MA, even though that's only really one part of the rules. This was maybe the single project I'm most proud of in terms of my role in it and the results. This really modernized the whole tender offer reporting scheme, that not only the disclosure, but actually the circumstances under which companies could make communication to the public when they were engaged in takeovers. And this was something that the rules were ultimately adopted in 1999. They were proposed the previous year. This was proposed at the same time as the aircraft carrier,
right,
which is, I think, had become pretty famous, even though those rules were never adopted. I was not on the aircraft carrier team. I was on the Regulation MA team, because at that point, there were some changes we haven't really discussed yet, but the Office of Mergers and Acquisitions reported to me. So I worked with very fine people on that project. Dennis Garris was the chief of the office. And then Jim Maloney and P.J. Himmelfarb were on the proposing release. Jim Maloney was on the adopting release. And they were a great team to work on. The funny thing is, it shows, I'll tell you a little bit of an internal story about Regulation MA. One of the centerpieces is the free communication scheme. At that time, it was very radical, because under the Securities Act, generally, if you're going to have any kind of a registered offering, there would be strict rules in place prohibiting the company from conditioning the market by talking about the company or its securities, except under highly regulated circumstances. That has been very much liberalized today, but the first liberalization started really with Regulation MA. The aircraft carrier was also going to regulate the communication scheme in a more restrictive way. Well, we had the two rulemaking teams, and there was a lot of rivalry. I won't get into the details, but there was a little bit of acrimoniousness going. The aircraft carrier team felt that they were in charge and they could tell the Reg MA team what to do. We felt that our project was just as important and there was no reason for them to tell us what to do. The division director, whom at that point was Brian Lane, actually fostered the rivalry a little bit, which generally I would think is not a good idea, but in this case it worked out well, and I have to compliment the result, because at one point Dennis got angry. Dennis Garris, the chief of the Office of Mergers and Acquisitions, he had been fairly conservative and regulatory on whether we should liberalize communications. And I tried to encourage him to think more broadly, but I think he was a little resistant. Then Brian Lane said, well, the aircraft carrier team had their system for liberalizing communication, so you, the Reg MA team, have to do the same thing, unless you can convince me that there is a different approach that is warranted. Well, so Dennis got mad, so he sat and thought, and then he came up with the idea there should be totally free communications. Maybe filing them, but there should be no restriction, which was much more expansive than what the aircraft carrier proposed. And he had a good reason for it. He had a very good idea for why merger and acquisition were different in a number of ways. And he sold me on it, and he sold Brian Lane on it, and we went out with that proposal. And it was ultimately adopted. The aircraft carrier was never adopted. And
Can I ask, was Reg FD being talked about at this point, or was that still a little bit in the future?
I don't
know. On the subject of communications, I mean.
Well, that is a different kind of communication. That's not communication, the connection with... because I'm talking about the kind of communication companies make in connection with their filing. So Reg D, FD is a little bit more like communication they make generally to analysts and to the trading public. There are certain interactions, but it's not quite the same. But I think that Reg MA, we were very proud of getting it adopted, especially when the aircraft carrier wasn't. We felt like at least we had a really significant project that the division could show for its efforts, and subsequent rulemaking. A few years later, when Alan Beller got involved with liberalizing the 33 Act, it was kind of a successor to the aircraft carrier, mm-hmm. done in a different way. I think they made use of some of the Reg MA concept and some of the liberalization, so we felt that our project had far-reaching implication. It was a very exciting time, and we really enjoyed it. Later on, there was other tender offer rulemaking, including the cross-border rules for different companies in different countries making tender offers that included U.S. shareholders and vice versa, and that was a very interesting and substantive project too, but I would say of all my projects, and especially in the area of tender offers, my heart would be given to Regulation MA. Some of the other areas...
Can I ask, in general, would the tenor of rulemaking be different if a rule is made just to modernize the system to provide more effective or efficient disclosure versus ones that are driven by external events? Of course, mergers and acquisitions is a very hot topic in the 1980s. Maybe it's calmed down a little bit in the 1990s. Does that give you more space to in the rulemaking process?
Well, it's hard to say because there are definitely hot topics, and when there are hot topics, then there are different sides to it. I think you're correct that at the time we adopted Reg MA, we got a lot of comment, pro and con. And one thing I have to say about the rulemaking process is that we take public comment very seriously. Mm-hmm. But generally, there was good acceptance of what we were trying to accomplish. While at other times, if there are external events driving it, you hear from all sources, and there are many very inconsistent comments, and you really have to sort out which ones are well taken.
Yeah, I guess one of the... that's very interesting. I think, you know, when we were talking about beneficial ownership reporting, for example, my knowledge of this topic is kind of from the macro level, where it's often associated with things like defense against takeovers and that sort of thing. And so I'm wondering, you know, how much, you know, that context would be on your mind when you're actually in the depths of the process of formulating the rules.
Well, I don't know if undermined is the word I would use, but you definitely have to take all points of view into account. And that is not easy. One project that was ongoing, or at least being thought about when I was on this desk, which I have not seen emerge in the light of day, is to shorten the reporting period for Schedule 13D, the beneficial ownership reporting rule, which the statute had said 10 days. And we got the Dodd-Frank rulemaking gave the staff the authority to shorten the time period by rulemaking. Well, at a certain point, I really wish that the statute had just shortened the period instead of giving the staff the authority to shorten the time period, because that meant we'd have to go through rulemaking. And it sounded initially like an easy thing. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, these days, communication move at great speed. Why should a company have 10 days after it crosses a 5% threshold to file a report? Surely wouldn't shareholders and the trading market benefit from hearing a lot sooner? And in fact, it was turned out to be a more complex decision than the staff had envisioned. We began hearing from shareholder activists arguing very strenuously that, in fact, it would hamper their business and it would hamper takeovers, and takeovers were a good thing for shareholders, so it could reduce shareholder value. Now, some of this is a little overblown, I think, but it became clear that there were two very sharply opposed camps as to whether to shorten the time period or not. And that's something, and it shows actually as part of the rulemaking process that there's a good reason for getting public comment, because the staff in its great wisdom doesn't know everything. We really need comment from the outside, but it also shows that if a topic becomes too controversial, maybe it won't be dealt with. And quite frankly, I don't know now. I could be wrong. I haven't been on the staff for over a year. Maybe, for all I know, tomorrow they're going to issue a Sunshine Act notice saying they're going to be voting on whether to propose rules shortening that 10-day reporting period. But my own thought, and I'm not saying that anything that isn't public, because people were filing rulemaking petitions and filing comments on the SEC's website and talking about it at conferences. So the controversial nature of that potential change is very well known. So whether, in fact, that controversy will mean no change is made in the area or not, I don't know.
Okay.
I just wanted to at least quickly touch on a couple of other topics that have been significant in terms of my career, certainly. One of them is the international area.
Yeah.
We might actually take a step back. When we last saw where my career was, I had the Office of Disclosure Policy, which was the rulemaking office, report to me. Subsequently, Brian Lane became division director. I actually had two people named Brian who used to work for me and then ended up being division director, so they ended up being my boss, Brian Lane and Brian Braheny. It didn't bother me since I did not have any ambition to be division director myself, which had got to be one of the most difficult jobs around. But Brian Lane, who had been in the rulemaking office, was now division director, so he abolished the rulemaking office. He decided that rules should be done in different offices around the division. I disagreed with him, and I didn't think it was the right decision, but he was the division director. He got to do what he wanted, and of course he didn't put me out of a job. He still put me in charge of a lot of different rulemaking, and he also put the Office of Tender Offers under me and my part of my portfolio. And that was very interesting, very exciting, because I got back to the tender offers area, which you heard me say I enjoyed so much when I was an AD special counsel and I worked on tender offers. And then you heard me say I worked on the Reg MA rulemaking, but that was after I got the Office of Tender Offers as part of my portfolio. And we subsequently renamed it the Office of Mergers and Acquisitions. So I didn't like the fact that Brian had abolished the rulemaking office, but I appreciated the fact that he gave me this very interesting area back, and that I had a lot of fun with that office, not only dealing with the office on the filings, the reviews of tender offers, and they also reviewed proxy contests. So I got involved in very interesting issues from a practical point of view, but then I also got involved in the rulemaking for those areas. Then, when David Martin became division director, he decided to reinstate the rulemaking office. And he asked me if I was interested in having it back. And I said, well, I might be a little burned out with rulemaking, and I really like having the Office of Mergers and Acquisitions. So he didn't put that back onto my portfolio, but instead he gave me two other offices, the Office of Small Business Policy and the Office of International Corporate Finance. So I then had the three offices. So I was very grateful to David and very appreciative of the fact that he trusted me enough to have these three very significant areas under my ambit. So the two other areas I wanted to then touch on in terms of significant projects were the international area and the small business area. The international area, over time, and the international, the Office of International Corporate, like the Office of Mergers and Acquisition, reviewed filings. In that case, it reviewed filings made by foreign governments as well as foreign private issuers, by which we mean not private companies because they'd be public companies, but foreign companies that are not governments. So that office reviewed filings by those entities and also handled rulemaking for issues regarding foreign companies. And among other things...
So, like debt issuance, you mean?
Like what?
Well, you said not yeah. like debt. Well, not yeah. public filings, yeah. filings from public companies, which yeah. would be equities. So I assume we're talking about debt.
Well, no. Foreign governments would only be debt. But right. foreign public companies that were not governments, they could be issuing... debt or equity, just like U.S. companies
okay.
and can issue debt or equity. And these would be foreign companies that would be offering securities in the U.S. Mm-hmm. as well as perhaps other places. So they would have to comply with our rules. And
but they might be traded on foreign exchanges?
Right, exactly. Okay. Gotcha. Sometimes they'd be traded on U.S. exchanges, sometimes foreign exchanges, sometimes both. And there were a number of rulemaking projects. Some of them were very highly technical. But, for example, there were issues on foreign issuer deregistration. At what point would a foreign issuer that was filing and required to make filing with the SEC be permitted to cease filing? I don't think I'll go into that here because it's highly technical, but it was something that involved a lot of staff, time, and effort. The chief of the office, Paul Dudek, was and is a real expert in those areas. We also, there's an exemption from U.S. registration for foreign private issuers called Rule 12G32B, which is perhaps not exactly catchy, but one previous associate director, Mickey Beach, who had the Office of International Corporate Finance under her portfolio actually had a license plate that said 12G32B, so I suppose I could have considered that at one point, but I never did. At any rate, there was a very substantial rulemaking project to revise and modernize that exemption. Basically, with foreign issuers also, there were also projects involving disclosure. Foreign private issuers file registration statements and annual reports just like domestic companies do. Domestic companies have to file quarterly reports as well as current reports on Form 8K. Foreign companies don't have to do that, but they do have to file Form 6K, which is basically report anything that is already public or that the company is required to file in its home jurisdiction. So there are issues about how that scheme works and in particular what the disclosure is like for foreign companies who have their own regulators after all. And the challenge there is to create a balance. On the one hand, they have their own regulator and they don't necessarily work exactly the same as U.S. companies, so they shouldn't be charged with regulation that either is too costly or is not pertinent. On the other hand, if they don't have good, solid disclosure, we're not doing the investors of the United States a service when they buy those securities. So and we want investors to be able to rely on their filings. So when we have disclosure rules, or when we change the disclosure scheme, we always want to keep that in mind as a little bit of a tension between having specialized disclosure and giving accommodation versus not giving them a break over and above mm-hmm. what U.S. companies might be expected to do, not giving them an unwarranted break. It's interesting, the same kind of thing comes up in the small business area, which is the other one of my three main areas during most of my career. In the small business area, you also have a question of, on the one hand, making accommodations for small businesses and allowing them, not putting them into a regulatory straitjacket where it costs them so much to comply with our regulation that it's going to stifle capital formation. On the other hand, if their disclosure is not good, this is going to be a problem for the investing public. Either they're going to buy based on disclosure that is not as full as it should be, or they may, in fact, feel that they can't rely on small businesses and therefore it's a disincentive to investors buying those securities. So that's another area where the rules have to create a balance. Now that office, which I supervise, unlike my two other offices, did not review its own filings. The filings, registration statements filed by small businesses were reviewed by operations and not reviewed or co-reviewed by that office, but that office dealt with and does deal with all of the policy issues relating to small business as well as the rulemaking relating to small business. And I got involved in a number of those. That office kind of went through a little bit of an evolution. When I first had the office report to me, I think it was seen as a little bit of a backwater. Things were quiet. It was a small office, which actually it still is a small office, but a small business was not necessarily looming large on anybody's horizon. That changed very much over the years. Alan Beller put together an advisory committee on small businesses, which that office got very heavily involved in, and that raised the profile of the office. Subsequently, over time, especially with the Jobs Act,
yeah.
The profile of the office really boomed. There was another, advisory committee, one that is still small and emerging companies, which is still ongoing. Both of these advisory committees included people from who were members of the public, not the staff, although there was a lot of staff support. But the idea was to get ideas from people who worked for companies or in some cases law firms or other organizations about steps that should be taken in the regulatory area to improve, to modernize regulation. In the case of small businesses, to improve this balance, to do as much as we could for capital formation mm-hmm. while not impairing investor protection.
I mean, that seems to be particularly a sensitive thing in this area straight through. I mean, from
yes.
in the early 1990s, you had the intense concern with penny stock fraud and that sort
yes.
of thing. And
yes.
even right up now to crowdfunding and the availability of that tool to potential investors. I mean, it's...
Well, I've seen the regulatory pendulum mm-hmm. swing back and forth many times during my career, and I was less aware of it before I became an associate director. But once I became an associate director and I was involved in rulemaking and other policy issues, it's very apparent. Some of this would depend on who the chairman was. Some of it, and it's not strictly a matter of party politics.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't strictly a matter of all the Democrats are liberal and they care about protecting investors and the Republicans are conservative and they don't want there to be a big regulatory burden and they want to encourage capital formation. Some of that is true, but I think it's also fair to say that all of the chairmen and commissioners do care about investor protection. Nobody wants to throw it out the window. And people had ideas which did not always go according to party politics beliefs, although sometimes it did, about what the best approach was. And so I have seen some times where we were charged with responsibilities to increase our regulation and told, you know, there are these potential loopholes, they need to be stopped. And then there were other times when the focus was more on why should we have these regulations that prevent companies from taking their security to market because the costs are so great. So it's a very interesting dynamic. Right now, I would say it's hard to know which way the dynamic is because it's both, because you have certain forces in Congress saying we overregulate, we should roll back the Dodd-Frank Act. Then you have other forces in Congress saying, why haven't you done all of your mandated Dodd-Frank and Jobs Act rulemaking? Why don't you do other things that will protect investors? And so I feel that it's a very difficult dynamic. I admire Mary Jo White, the current chairman, tremendously, and I don't know how she could navigate these shoals any better. It tends to slow down rulemaking when you sometimes have hostile voices on both sides in Congress, but she, like everybody else, is very much aware of this need for a balance, even if different people would balance their regulation and deregulation in different ways.
Generally, we view that commission, especially the chairman level, as kind of the intersection point between the political end of the process, particularly on the Hill, maybe to a certain extent, the executive branch, and the staff. To what extent are priorities communicated through the commission level to the rulemaking process?
Well, they are, you know, the division directors, of course, talk to the chair and other commissioners, and they are definitely communicated. The origin of a rulemaking project can come from many sources. It could be mandated rulemaking. It could be not exactly mandated, but something where we get letters from Congress about it. It could be the chairman has an idea. It could be the division director has an idea. And how those projects get, although if the division director had an idea, obviously he or she would have to sell at least the chairman on it, because rulemaking takes a lot of time and effort. It really sucks up resources. So you shouldn't just be going off on a project because you think it's a neat idea without having some kind of a commitment that the resources are worthwhile. With small business, I did want to mention a couple of the small business projects. There have been many through the years, but the Dodd-Frank Act required us to impose bad actor requirements the Dodd-Frank Act called for us imposing bad actor requirements on various rules, Regulation D and other rules. We have certain rules that permit the offering of securities without registration. And there are certain requirements, including accredited investor definition. Not everybody can buy these securities. Regulation D had been by far the most prominent of these rules. There's actually a series of rules under Regulation D. And people have to be who purchase. I'm oversimplifying, but there are certain entities that are allowed, and then there are certain other individuals. There are certain individuals, if they have income or net worth of certain amounts. So these people who are permitted to buy unregistered securities under these rules are called accredited investors. There are issues concerning who should be an accredited investor, which are extremely controversial and are ongoing today. The Dodd-Frank Act included some references to the bad actor rule. Before the rules were proposed and adopted, there were certain rules calling for sales of unregistered securities where, quote, bad actors that would be not permitted to offer securities under these rules. These would be not only felons, but companies that had engaged in certain rulemaking violations. And by rulemaking, we extended the bad actor requirements to throughout Regulation D. We made them uniform and consistent with Regulation A, which I'll come to. And we really rationalized the whole scheme. That was actually fairly difficult regulation, even though it was part of a statute. But it got more complex than one would have thought. We were very proud of ourselves for getting it not only proposed but actually adopted. Now, the other thing that this was my last rulemaking project, Regulation A, is one of the rules permitting unregistered sales of securities. Is sometimes called a mini registration because there is an offering document that has to be filed with the SEC, and the SEC has to staff does review it. So it's a little bit different from Regulation D, which should not call for that kind of a disclosure document being filed with the SEC and being reviewed. Regulation A had not been used much in recent years because the dollar amounts for the offering that permitted are very small, and there have been the number of Regulation A offerings in the past few years have been in the double or even single digits. Well, I'm not quite sure how this happened. Well, I think I know. Basically, Congress ended up taking an interest in Regulation A, and they put it in the Jobs Act, requiring us to revamp and improve Regulation A. And so the challenge is to get it to be a rule that will be useful for companies, because if we do all this wonderful work and then nobody uses it, that would be pretty sad. And Congress required us to go up to from $5 million to $50 million in the maximum offering size. So we knew, so that would, of course, be more of an incentive for companies to use it. But it did mean coming up with a whole new disclosure scheme. The staff called it Regulation A+. And the last project I worked on was actually the proposing release for Regulation A+. Initially, we were going to keep that as an internal name. Some people thought it sounded too cute, but we ended up, I think, being proud of it and just calling it Regulation A+. So since I left, and it took about a year, the rule was adopted. I was not, of course, involved in the adopting release, although I knew a lot of the controversial areas, and I knew how hard it would be, and I was very proud of the staff remaining to work on it when I saw that it had been adopted. One of the most significant issues, which, again, I can tell you because it's certainly public, is the question of preemption, because this is an intersection. Regulation A was in an intersection between state and federal securities law, and it was very clear that this would not be likely to be useful to companies if they continue to have to comply with state requirements as well as federal requirements. So, and the states wrote letters of comment vociferously objecting to any kind of preemption, but also saying they were going to have a more streamlined system for reviewing filings, because when people complained about having to comply with the state requirements because it wasn't just one state, it would be every state that they wanted to sell in, and those requirements could be inconsistent or time-consuming. So the state didn't just say, don't preempt us because we are your regulatory partners, we're valuable, we help find fraud, but they also said, and we're also going to improve our own system and come up with an easier system of regulation so companies will not find it as difficult to comply with our rule. Well,
Have this been an ongoing conversation? I know that they had NISMIA back in the mid-90s.
Yes.
I'm told that that was not entirely successful, so I'm kind of wondering about your perspective on
that. No, well, it is very interesting. With NISMIA, I was not closely involved with NISMIA, but definitely it was very difficult because the states could not have been happy about that either. And NISMIA improved things a lot from the corporate point of view, but there were still areas where there was duplicative regulation, Regulation A being one of them. And so during the time period that the staff worked on the proposal, the states submitted comment letters, and after the proposals were issued, the proposals called for preemption of certain offerings, not all of them. The states submitted many additional comment letters, some of which, and you can read them on our website, some of which took a very unpleasant and acrimonious tone. The rules as adopted did call for preemption, and of course, all I know since I retired is what's public, but the two states have sued, Massachusetts and Montana have sued the SEC, and it will be interesting to see how that goes. I hope that the new regulatory scheme works and is effective, and that it proved to be a very useful means for small companies to raise capital.
I think we skipped a bit quickly over the Sarbanes-Oxley period. I'm wondering if you can expand on kind of the, from your perspective and what you were doing, what the key impacts there were. From, for example, the small business perspective or the international perspective. I know it's in the aftermath of Sarbanes-Oxley that people start to worry perhaps more deeply than they had been in the earlier period about reconciling the rules of, for example, the accounting standards.
Yes. I was not involved with the accounting standards per se. I was involved with some of the rules involving certifications under Sarbanes-Oxley. And the first Small Business Advisory Committee I mentioned was very largely devoted to Sarbanes-Oxley issues. The rulemaking itself, as you said, a lot of it was accounting, and that was something that was, I would say it was very significant overall, but I wouldn't say that my own particular highlights in terms of the big rulemaking projects involved those.
Okay, it wasn't really within your sphere so much.
Yes.
I see. Okay, another thing that I wanted to ask about the international area is to what degree agreements hammered out, say, through IOSCO or something like that. How much did that set what exactly the tasks were within the SEC?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that, because the issue of international regulators and their role is quite significant. One of the jobs of the Office of International Corporate Finance, which reported to me, is to be the liaison with the CorpFin liaison with IOSCO. There were also IOSCO liaisons in the Commission Chief Accountant's Office, and the commission has a separate Office of International Affairs, but CORPFIN was the primary interface with IOSCO for disclosure-related issues. There is also another international organization called OECD that deals with corporate governance matters. So both of those organizations have played significant roles, but especially IOSCO, because at one point there was an agreement hammered out for disclosure. See, in general, there's a certain tension because, yes, the SEC is very proud of our disclosure scheme. We're not we want to be a model for others to follow. We're not necessarily signing on to harmonize our regulation with those of other countries. However, we do realize that there is a time for there are certain kinds of filings, perhaps, where it makes sense to allow other companies' regulation to control. There is actually a multi-jurisdictional disclosure system called the MJDS with Canada, where the U.S. and Canada worked out schemes so that each country can make filings in the other country but complying with its own home country regulation. Now, the U.S. and Canada are very close in regulation, so that makes more sense. With many countries, it wouldn't make much sense or it'd be very difficult to get that kind of result. Even many countries that have very highly developed securities regulation don't have systems that have important differences between the they have important differences from the U.S., so it'd be much harder to harmonize. So there's been this ongoing thread of how much do we harmonize our regulation with theirs, how much can they harmonize with us, and at one point some disclosure standards were worked out with IOSCO, which the SEC then implemented into its rule for foreign private issuers. But most of the time, it's not as direct as that. Most of the time, it's more on the level of task forces and best practices.
Mm-hmm. Did you you mentioned one of the themes that we wanted to return to is technology. Did you remain involved with EDGAR through its evolution? I think we left it in the early 90s with the
Yes, I'd like to talk about that.
Yeah.
Now I need a break.
Absolutely. Okay.
Well, EDGAR had been a theme in my career, not only during the initial rulemaking for phasing in companies, domestic companies first and foreign companies later, but whenever technological development came along or when the system was modernized, there were likely to be rule changes. I was actually on the group that considered, helped evaluate requests for proposals at one point when EDGAR was modernized. That was kind of a fascinating experience, me with a bunch of techies. And I don't know if I'd want to do it again, but it was quite interesting. There were a number of issues that had to be dealt with. And, for example, once the system could accept HTML, we had to change our rules, and we had to provide for pictures and graphs being permitted. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of policy issues that came up with EDGAR. I wanted to talk about actually the internet and dissemination, and then XBRL, because those are all aspects of the technology aspect of my career. As I mentioned, when EDGAR started, it was before the internet, and people or entities could subscribe to the dissemination stream and they could get the filings that way. So people had to pay for them. At a certain point, the internet came into being, and New York University purchased a subscription to the dissemination stream, so which they then made available to the public, mm-hmm. so everybody could see it. They did this, I think, for a year as an experiment. And you know, disclosure mm-hmm. is what the SEC is all about. From our point of view, the more people who see things, the better. So this was certainly appeared to be a very favorable development from the point of view of the investors and the analysts. However, at the end of the year or so, NYU said, well, we're not going to fund it anymore. It's not our job to do it indefinitely. This was a trial. So then the SEC had to figure out, okay, well, what do we do? Now, this is amusing. This was 1995, and the SEC did not have a website, but this is just when websites were getting started, really. My own knowledge of the internet actually that really dates from 1995 for this reason. We got together a task force. I was Corp Fin's representative on the task force, but there were people all over the commission to decide whether the SEC should have a website, which is very funny now, and also whether we should put the Edgar filings on it. Both of these seemed like absolute no-brainers, but at the time there were many complications. One of the complications was that we had a contract with a company to do the dissemination. Mm-hmm. You know, there was money changing hands. We couldn't just say, oh, by the way, you're paying us for the privilege of disseminating these filings and then reselling them, but we're also going to give them away free. So that had to be worked out as a contractual matter. What we came up with is, yes, we would have a website, and yes, we would put the Edgar filings on it, but there would be a 24-hour delay. So people who wanted to look at filings for free could find them on our website with a 24-hour delay, but people for whom it was important to get them in real time would still be paying for dissemination. And I guess that was worked out. I was not involved with the actual negotiation with the dissemination company, but presumably that was worked out as a contractual matter. However, I don't know how long it took, maybe a couple of years, maybe longer. At a certain point, it began to look really bad that we had a 24-hour delay, mm-hmm. even if there were good legal reasons for it. And at a certain point, the contractual matters were resolved and the 24-hour delay was eliminated. And so Edgar filings are available on our website. And, of course, the website is extremely useful in many other ways. It has information about all the SEC divisions. It has information about all the rulemaking projects, including public comments that are much easier mm-hmm. to find. People don't have to go to the public reference room and dig them up. So it's kind of hard to even imagine Edgar without the internet. Mm-hmm. It just looks like they were made for each other, but that wasn't true. Then Edgar, I should tell you, stands for Electronic Data Gathering, Analysis, and Retrieval. One of my former co-workers, Herbert Shaw, won a prize, I think it was a $100 savings bond, for suggesting the name. And the data gathering and the retrieval are there. How about the analysis? That was always a little bit of a weak point. Back at one point, after we phased in companies to Edgar, we engaged in some rulemaking, which I was involved in, on what we were called financial data schedules. The idea was that every company that had making a filing containing financial statements would submit a separate form in a structured tagged format that would give some key data elements. And that would be useful for the for investors, analysts, etc., to use in computing ratios, because the data would be tagged instead of something that you would have to actually go inside a filing to find. Well, that was not a success. I think we may have had too few data elements, maybe not the right ones, and company didn't really respect the rules. I don't think they really took great care to do it properly. So that ended up being very little used by investors. But in the years later, the idea of a more robust system for tagging data that could be used for analysis came back in the form of XBRL. And that led to...
Extensible Business Reporting Language.
Oh, very good, very good.
I was just thinking
maybe we should tell people what it is.
Yes.
But that was actually, in a way, probably my most annoying rulemaking project ever. But this was... Chairman Cox was very big on technology. And here's an example of a Republican who was not completely deregulatory, as I was saying earlier, because he believed very strongly in technology and he wanted to improve technology. And so he was the one who really made the push for having an XBRL system and having it mandatory. We did have a pilot system at first, but ultimately rules were proposed and adopted requiring companies to submit in electronic format, in addition to their basic filings, a 10K or whatever, also an electronic document, if that's a word, that would tag all of the data in that document, including the financial statement footnotes. It applied just to the financial statement and the footnote, not to other areas, which, however, have been thought about from time to time, and people have suggested that maybe it should be expanded to management discussion and analysis, or to executive compensation information, or other information in a proxy statement, and those have not yet been done, although it's possible that one day they would be. But right now, I think the focus is still, first there was a phase-in period for XBRL, and it still does not apply to foreign private issuers because a different system is needed for them because their financial statements are filed not according to GAAP, but according to IFRS. So you need a different system, and that has been discussed and worked on but hasn't yet been implemented. So you could say that XBRL, it's right now in a somewhat controversial area because some people say it's expensive for companies to put together and are investors really using it? And some people are saying, yeah, the more you have it and the more it's spread to all companies, the more it will be used as a useful analytical tool. Mm-hmm. This gets into a policy area, you could say, and to what's the role of government versus the role of the private sector, because you could have said, look, why do we need this kind of analysis mandated by the government to have companies do? Why doesn't the private sector do it? Because there are, in fact, many companies that will extract data from filings, and they have their own systems for doing that. And why not just let them do it? One answer may be they don't necessarily do it to all companies. They do it for the ones where they can make money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the larger ones that maybe smaller companies would benefit, the trading markets would benefit if the database were pretty much universal in terms of public companies. And certainly the decision the commission made was to not rely on the private sector for that, but to, as I put it, put the analysis in Edgar and make companies do it. It was interesting to me because first I worked on financial data schedule. Then I worked on getting that requirement rescinded. And already you begin to feel like you've been hanging around too long when you work on a rule, and then you work on getting the rule rescinded. Then I worked on the next step, which is financial data schedule, which is a more I don't want to say more elegant, but a more sophisticated and complex version of that rule, but one that has aspects that should make it more successful. So I will be very interested in following how that continued to work.
Okay. Are there any detail-oriented matters that we want to go into? Because I thought we might start to kind of pull back and look at some of the broad picture from your time there. But if you want to address anything else.
I think probably it's time for the big picture.
Okay. Well, I think you mentioned earlier that we might look at just the general changes in the process of rulemaking. So since we've been talking about the individual rules, let's start with that. What have been the big shifts?
Well, one of the big shifts has been that there's much more emphasis on economics. Although we always, since I was involved with rulemaking, had a division or an office. They've been through various names, but not in Corp Fin, but the commission has always had an office devoted to economics. That had gotten larger and more important, and the amount of economic analysis in every rulemaking project had become more important, partly because of litigation, which the SEC had tended to lose in many cases.
These are the cost-benefit analysis changes.
Right, exactly. Right. And so that is a big difference. One big difference, I see it as being more political. Now, I'm not 100% sure that's right, because I think even at the beginning of my rulemaking career, when I was maybe less attuned to things or less likely to be involved, there were probably political aspects that I was less aware of, but I feel like Congress really gets into the act. And there is, between the commissioners, what I said earlier about how you can't just say it's a Democratic-Republican thing is true. But having said that, it is partly a Democratic-Republican thing, and partly you do the most likely. But when a vote on a rule is not unanimous, it is very likely that the Democrats and the Republicans will be lined up differently. There are certainly many more dissents or commissioner statements on various rules. Back when I first got involved with rulemaking, the commission was a little bit less involved in the project. I don't even know how far in advance they knew about the project. There was an open commission meeting about every couple of weeks. So about 10 days before a meeting, we would calendar a release and send it up to the commission. And it seems unbelievable that the commission might not have known that was coming. But that, in fact, may be the case. Now, they know about it. Certainly the chairman had to sign on, but other commissioners as well know about projects far in advance, and they demand to see drafts far in advance. Many years ago, Commissioner Fleischman demanded to see a draft before the calendar draft, and we were all aghast. You know, we thought it was so nervy, and that seems pretty funny now, because the commissioners like to see drafts at early stages. They have their own counsels or legal assistants that spend time looking at it. The legal assistants give comments to the staff. The staff had to decide how to handle the comments, which the staff may or may not agree are well taken. And sometimes we're perfectly willing to implement one commissioner's comments, but then another commissioner won't like that. Mm-hmm. So that has gotten much more difficult. Now,
could you just say a few words about that? I mean, of course, when something passes the commission, it's by a vote, which can be 5-0, 3-2.
Yeah.
But before that, to what extent is there an expectation that you're going to be developing rules around consensus versus rules that can win a vote?
Well, there is always, I mean, people always want a consensus. It's very nice to get 5-0. I was really astonished and pleased that the adopting release for Regulation A-plus was 5-0. Again, because I had not been involved in the adopting phase of that project. So I can imagine it took some doing and some negotiation, some getting to. But There are times when something had to be done, either because it's mandated rulemaking or just because it's viewed as very significant. And, you know, you don't want to be paralyzed by saying, okay, if we can't get Commissioner Eck to sign on, we're never going to do anything in this area. So I think that's primarily a chairman's call and to whether to go ahead or not. I have to say, I have a long-term perspective on this. I saw recently an article that was saying, criticizing Mary Jo White as chairman for not getting consensus enough at the time and saying the commission is too fragmented. I personally think she'd done a marvelous job of getting consensus on at least some things, like Regulation A+. But it's not like there was a golden age where there was always consensus. I certainly remember some commission meetings back when I was much earlier in the rulemaking project and rulemaking, in the rulemaking phase of my career that were acrimonious, where they actually displayed a lot of acrimony toward the staff. And that's much less likely to happen now. Now I think the commissioners are very nice and very appreciative to the staff of their hard work, even if they end up saying they have to vote against something. But I can think of some times where there was some unpleasantness directed at the staff. And I can think of a couple of cases where things were actually changed at the meeting. I can think of one project that we brought up to a public meeting, and one of the commissioners didn't like it. It was shut down in flames and in public. That would not happen now. And I can think of another project where the two alternatives were proposed. The staff selected an alternative that was more regulatory. One of the commissioners preferred an alternative that was more deregulatory. And at the open meeting, he convinced the others, or at least a majority of the others, to vote his way. So at the meeting, the staff were directed to go back and take that release and rewrite it to adopt the more deregulatory alternative. So I don't think that would be likely to happen now. Things are too scripted. There are less likely to be comments. There are less likely to be questions asked at public meetings by commissioners. It's more likely that the commissioners will each make their own statements because they will have resolved question in advance, or at a public meeting, a commissioner may say to the director of Court Finn, and we discussed this with you, can you tell the others how you answered this? So it's a little bit more scripted in that sense. Commission meeting used to be really nerve-wracking because you never knew which question would be asked. And it's still a little nerve-wracking because you never know how things will go. And if you've worked for months on a project, it's very nice to know that it's going to be voted on. But yeah, you don't quite know. So I won't say that the staff isn't nervous, but I think they're less likely to be unknown outcomes. If in fact there were going to be a question as to whether something was passed at all, I think they would not hold the open meeting. I think it's very unlikely they would have a meeting and then the project would be voted down.
There are some people who have said that the commission has become a bit more political, or at least philosophically strident in terms of regulatory versus deregulatory views. Is that something that's come and gone in waves, or is that more of a linear change, or do you even agree that
I see it as a linear change. I don't know if I'm right, because maybe the more recent period assumes greater importance in one's memories, and it may be that I also know more of the politics that's going on than I did at an earlier point in my career. But I think that may be right.
Yeah. So we started out talking about how you were one of just a few women in your division. We haven't returned to that subject since then. Of course, there's been great change in that time. I'm wondering if you can discuss your perception of some of those changes. Did it start more at the higher up levels as women became? There were always from the 1970s one woman commissioner, and then of course Mary Shapiro became the first non-acting chairwoman.
Yes.
But then there were also division directors, or did it start more at the staff level?
Well, it's both. At the staff level, there always seemed to be, since I was on the staff in 1974, at least some women in higher places. We had Ernestine Zipoy, who was an accountant by training, but she was... She might have been a branch chief when I came, but then we quickly became an assistant director and ultimately an associate director. And although an accountant, she was one of the smartest lawyers around. She was, in fact, one of the smartest people I ever met. And she was... So we also have Mickey Beach, Mickey, nicknamed for Mary Beach, who, when I came... may have been the head of the rulemaking office, but then was promoted to being associate director. And Ruth Appleton was the chief of the Office of Tender Offers. With Mickey, I remember the first time I interacted with her, I was in the branch, I was in operation, but I was working on a special rulemaking project. And we had a meeting in her office. So she was an associate director. And as we're talking about Form 10K disclosure, which is what the rulemaking project was about, her phone rang and it was one of her kids who was in grade school. And I hear her say, what? Oh, that's terrible. Well, try to calm down. Don't cry. He's at the bottom of his cage. Well, you know, why don't you go see so-and-so next door? So she was being a working mother there. It turned out that she hung up. She explained one of the guinea pigs was evidently sick and subsequently died. But then the conversation veered off a little bit because several people in the room were parents and had kids with guinea pigs, and there was a conversation about the colors of guinea pigs and so forth before it returned to business. And at first I was a little put off, like, gee, should we be discussing this? And I was young, and I didn't have kids, which I still don't, but I do understand. And now I look back on it and I say, well, this is kind of neat. She was a good example of someone who was very highly respected, and she may have been the highest level woman in Corp Fin at the time and had recently been promoted. But at the same time, she had her, you know, she had her children whom she gave very high priority to when she would answer a phone call. So, as time went on, there were more and more women. There were more women attorneys before there were women accountants. Mm-hmm. I think I mentioned that there was one woman accountant in Corp Fin at a certain point, not counting Ernestine, who was in a higher level position and no longer working just as an accountant. And at one time, in the rulemaking office, there were three married women, all of whom became pregnant at the same time, one of whom was the office chief, and I was the associate director over that office. So I thought it was very funny. There were some people who were quite annoyed. And, of course, it's a challenge for a supervisor to deal with when you have three out on maternity leave at once. But, as I pointed out, there wasn't anything I could do about it. And I guess that was really a tribute to the fact that we had these very bright and very professional women. And in fact, at one point in the chain of command, we had not only the women in the office, the chief of the office was a woman, then there was me, then there was Elise Walter, who was the deputy director, then there was Linda Quinn, who was the director. So it was... So it was quite an evolution. I think one of the things that I am proudest of in my career is that I helped make it easier for women in the division to work part-time.
Mm-hmm.
This is someone whose name I don't want to give because of her privacy, but one of the people in my chain of command came, who was on maternity leave, came to my office to tell me she was resigning. And the reason she was resigning is that she felt that she needed to work part-time. And she knew that there was an absolute policy in Court Finn of not allowing people to work part-time. And I knew that was true, because actually in the chief counsel's office there was an attorney I knew who was a very good attorney who at one point wanted to work part-time after she adopted her second child, and she was told she could not do it. And they found her another job in the Division of Investment Management, which is interesting. Investment management would allow women to work part-time and Court Finn wouldn't.
Yeah, it's interesting that there wasn't an overarching policy for the commission as a whole.
Right. It was division by division, and mm-hmm. it was really what the division director wanted. So when this woman came to tell me she was resigning, I said, well, do you have another job? And she said, no. She said, I realize part-time work would be hard to get, but I feel like I have to do this. And I said, well, don't resign yet. Maybe they can find you a job in another division. Mm-hmm. And you want me to explore that? And she said, oh, yes, I really like that. And I'm so happy I did not accept her resignation, because I feel like I worked behind the scenes. I let higher-level people know that she was going to resign and she was very valuable, mm-hmm. and it was an office where we didn't necessarily get an abundance of applicants. And it'd be really nice if she could stay. And somehow, they worked it out. Initially, they said it was going to be a pilot project for Court Finn to see if part-time work could work out. And it was going to be a six-month pilot. But she stayed. And, of course, then it became division policy, mm-hmm. not the pilot. And this particular attorney, who eventually returned to full-time work, had a great career at the commission. And so I feel very good about that. I'm sure the policy would have been changed sooner or later anyway, mm-hmm. because now you would not be able to have a situation where it was a division by division. Well, this division director is okay with it, and this division director isn't. But I was glad that it would change when it was.
The increasing equality of women within the commission kind of map onto an increasing diversity, or did one lag the other in your
observation? Well, certainly another way in which the commission had changed. I would say women came before other kinds of diversity in terms of, you could look around the division and there would be a lot of women, but they would be mostly white people. So people of color mm-hmm. came later to the process. And still, I think, maybe in the securities industry as a whole, or maybe just at the commission, I don't think you would feel that there is a discrepancy. But now you look around, unlike my first SEC Speaks, but you would look around either at SEC Speaks or at some staff meeting or gathering, you would see Asian Americans, you will see African Americans, you will see people from different countries, and people whose native languages were different languages. I went to a meeting with the small business office one time, actually with a lunch with my office, and I said, gee, you should be the international office, because everybody in that office either was bilingual or who were raising bilingual children. And there were people from different countries married to each other who were raising children using English and German or English and Spanish or whatever the language was. And it was fun. It was very, very different. I think that the commission as a whole had tried to take steps to increase diversity, not just in terms of race, national origin, or color, but also different outlooks on life, different disciplines. And it's a very different place. And the change is certainly for the better.
Mm-hmm. We've had the opportunity to talk with a lot of the division directors of corporation finance, but of course, sadly, Linda Quinn died some years ago. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about her in particular.
Well, she was a very extremely bright person. She was not that easy to get along with. I felt like, on the one hand, she promoted me, mm-hmm. and I owe the fact that I'm an associate director to her. I kind of think I owed it to Elise, because mm-hmm. Elise may have been the one who encouraged her to pick me, but nevertheless, she did pick me, and she had that much confidence in me. And I think I told you that she wanted an outsider for the job, but then when she picked me, she said, "I know I said I wanted an outsider, but I really wanted you, and I have confidence in you." So that was very nice. We did not always get along, and
Elise said that she liked to really get involved in the process of rulemaking and that sort of thing. Huh?
Oh, she had very brilliant ideas, mm-hmm. and she got very involved. She was very imaginative. I would try to think of who were the most brilliant people I ever worked with. She would be one of them, and there were, I guess I would say, Ernestine Zappoy, whom I've also mentioned, Elise Walter, Alan Beller, and Meredith Cross are names that spring to mind. I remember once working with Linda on a rulemaking project that I was in charge of, and she was giving me comments on the release, and she had, once she saw it in writing, she had a vision for how it would work differently. And this was, I mean, she was not dissatisfied with the release. I mean, she wasn't, you know, she was complimentary, mm-hmm. but nevertheless, she wanted a change to reflect a lot of different ideas. And I went into the office the next day to work on them, and it took me 9 hours. And I always try to remember that later when I was supervising people who were implementing things themselves, mm-hmm. and I would wonder, why did it take you so long? Because even though it was not a question of saying the release had to be rewritten from scratch, there were so many ideas that had to be implemented in a consistent way throughout the release that it took a long time, but the release was undoubtedly better for it. So it was a challenging but very interesting experience.
Okay. Well, that, I think, brings us up to just the commission in general. I mean, you spent an extraordinary 40 years there. There are a few people who can give us that broad of a perspective on, you know, how it's changed just in general in that time period. I mean, one of the questions that we're always interested in is the resources that are available and the ability of the staff to cope with the tremendous amount of work that's put on them. And so that's one issue that I'd like you to address, but I'd also like you to address anything you wish.
Well, in terms of how it has changed, we mentioned the role of women, we mm-hmm. mentioned diversity, and we mentioned technology, which actually feeds into the resources issue, but I'd like to expand on that. Although there are better resources to help us do our jobs, I still say us, you notice, even though I've been retired for more than a year, there are computerized resources, there are databases, there are computerized legal research. The attorneys have computers. We generally do the typing ourselves because it's easier. The first rulemaking project I worked on, where that happened, was back in the early 90s, I think. We called it the Gang of Eight because there were eight projects we were doing at once, although they were not all major projects. And there weren't enough secretaries to go around, and I saw Elise was actually typing. I was kind of afraid. I was afraid the disk would explode or something. We had disks in those days, which were always getting corrupted. But I thought, well, if Elise can type, I can too. And I did that. Before computers, we had Lexitrons, and that were challenging to deal with. Those we let the secretary deal with, or at least I did.
Those word processors?
Yeah, they were word processors, and they were not easy because you had to go page by page. You had to put in footnote numbers manually, do an underline, then a slash, then backspace, and put in the number. Mm-hmm. And so we would do releases, which had a lot of footnotes, and not fill in the footnote numbers until the end, until we were ready to send it to the commission. One time I sent an action memo to the commission without footnotes, and I was very upset. Without footnote numbers, and I was very upset. I was afraid somebody would know, but it was an accident. But if, in fact, once you got the footnote numbers in, you send it to the commission, then if the commissioners want to change it, maybe they wanted to eliminate a footnote or to add a footnote, you tried to combine other footnotes or remove other footnotes later so you didn't have to renumber everything. So the technology has certainly changed and improved. Unfortunately, that may also mean our releases are longer and longer because we have not only the economic analysis but all of these other regulatorily mandated parts. So I don't know if that's a change for the better. But I think when you were asking about resources, you may have also meant the staff. And the staff, the size of the staff has certainly increased. But a lot of that increase in CorpFin had been in operation. The division was certainly fewer than 100 people when I arrived. The SEC was 2,000 nationwide, including all the regional offices. And now CorpFin is at least 400 or 500 people, and everything is much bigger. But I have to say, from my perspective, the part of the division that I was most familiar with, the support offices, the rulemaking and other policy things that those offices do, there had not been a great increase in size. Somewhat, but not in proportion. So maybe we really are doing more with less.
And it's, I guess, it's kind of in the operations area that, you know, you have, based on other oral histories that we've done, people have often pointed to things like safe harbor rules and just in general modernization of the rulemaking that makes the burden on the staff somewhat less, because you had a very cumbersome system in the 1970s originally, and as these things came in, it did become a bit easier to review disclosures and that sort of thing.
I don't know if the rules really make it easier to tell you, to review disclosure, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Now, I will say, well, again, the rulemaking process has gotten so difficult that the staff tend to try to find other ways to deal with things. We tend to try to find telephone interpretation to publish, which we call CDI, compliance and disclosure interpretation, or staff legal bulletin, or do no action or interpretive letters, including maybe global letters that will apply to all companies. So we try to find other ways to do it rather than do rulemaking, if we can legally do that. Of course, you can't really get around the rulemaking process when it is an appropriate topic for rulemaking, but we try. I don't know if that makes it any easier to review filings. I am not sure how they do it, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. Of course, with selective review, you can refine the criteria.
Yeah.
You have to, I guess,
another area, one of the things that prompts the question, I gather it wasn't quite what you worked on, but the move all the way from shelf disclosure all the way to the well-known seasoned issuers, that created a lot more efficiency.
Oh, that created a lot more, definitely. Yeah. And I worked on some of that, on certain aspects of that, although not, that wasn't the area of my major impact. That, in that sense, the rules have helped, changes have helped. Similarly, there were rule changes along the way that made certain kinds of filings automatic. Mm-hmm. And so the focus really is on freeing up the staff to review the filings that need to be reviewed.
Okay. Any West, comments for the record, or shall we wrap it up?
Well, I think we've pretty much covered it in a not too short period of time. It's been my work has always been interesting, and I feel like anybody who works for the SEC, whether it's a long or short time, is really privileged to have that as all or part of their careers.
All right, well, thank you very much. I appreciate the time that you've taken today, and I think this is a very good long-term perspective on the commission. I'm pleased that we have it.
Thank you.